Welcome to the Dialogue Studio, a podcast series brought to you by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. I'm your host, Lillian Koizumi. In this series, we introduce the center's work, interview scholars and youth in our community, and examine our founder, Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy and practice of dialogue, along with the ethos and strategies that shaped his approach. For Ikeda, the more severe the challenges we face, the more crucial it is that we persist in dialogue, because dialogue has the power to break down the walls of mistrust, hatred, and division in the hearts of people everywhere. We invite you to join us in this space to practice a deeper way of connecting with ourselves and others, and endeavor to transform our world one dialogue at a time. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Dialogue Studio. Happy September. I hope you all had time to relax and enjoy time with family and friends this past summer. We are back today for another episode of our What Do We Mean By series. This time, we will be unpacking What Do We Mean By Dialogue. As a Peace and Dialogue Center, we obviously talk a lot about dialogue here, specifically our founder Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy and practice of dialogue. We're always studying his ideas and approaches to dialogue and striving to put them into practice in all aspects of our work. Here is one of my favorite quotes from Ikeda on dialogue. Engaging in dialogue is a struggle to positively transform our own life as well as that of others. It is the act of breaking out of the shell of our lesser self, surmounting the wall of our callous ego, and creating and expanding positive connections with others. One scholar friend of the center who has written and spoken extensively about Ikeda's dialogic ethos and engagement is Dr. Olivier Urbain, who is the director of the Min-On Music Research Institute in Tokyo, Japan. He is the editor of the first volume dedicated to the topic of music and peacebuilding, Music and Conflict Transformation. His main source of inspiration is the philosophy and practice of dialogue of Daisaku Ikeda, the founder of the Min-On Concert Association. Publications on this topic include Daisaku Ikeda's Philosophy of Peace, Dialogue, Transformation, and Global Citizenship, as well as Peacebuilding 2020 in the journal Music and Arts in Action. His most recent publication, co-authored with Michael Golden, is titled Musicking, Consciousness, and Peacebuilding, published open access in the Journal of Consciousness Studies. Here at the center, we have studied Olivier's books as a way to help us deepen our understanding of Mr. Ikeda's approach and ideas around dialogue, which is why I'm so thrilled to have him join us in the studio today to help us unpack this concept. Let's jump into the conversation.
Well, Olivier, it's so wonderful to have you in the Dialogue Studio today. I know you're in Japan and I'm in Boston, so I love this cross-ocean conversation we're going to have. And you're really someone we always think about at the center when we're reflecting on Ikeda's philosophy and approach to dialogue. So being able to talk about dialogue with you today is really meaningful and special for me. And I think even more so because you're someone who not only talks about dialogue, you're really a true practitioner. I think, you know, we've been talking a lot about Ikeda's dialogues of the heart. And in just the few dialogues we've had, Olivier, I really feel that idea of the dialogue of the heart. I always feel it so much from you. And so again, I want to just welcome you and thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so for our listeners, Olivia, I was wondering if you could introduce yourself. I think maybe many of them know who you are or have heard your name, but whatever you would like to share with us today as your introduction. Yeah, please take it away.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful. Yes. So I am Olivier Urbain. I'm from Belgium, so the name is in French language, Olivier Urbain. In English, Olivier Urbain. So after being born and raised in Belgium, I spent 5 years in the United States at USC, doing a master's and a PhD in literature, in discourse analysis. After that, I moved to Japan to work at Tsukuba University and then to Hawaii for the Toda Institute. And now I'm back in Japan working for the Min-On Music Research Institute, where we study the impact, the potential impact of music on our lives, on our societies, on our world, and how we can make that better and more effective. And I'm always inspired by the work of your center. It's really very, very important to study, practice, develop the art of dialogue. And that's part of what I've done. And it's really great to be able to combine everything with music, with connections, with dialogue, and especially in those very, very difficult times for humanity, for the biosphere, for the whole planet. I think we are going through a pretty difficult phase right now. And being able to really connect with each other and dialogue through music, through photography, through language, to whatever means that help us connect. I think it's fantastic, and I'm so privileged to be able to contribute to that with people like yourself, who I consider really an expert in dialogue. And so, yeah, I could go on and on about me, but let's switch to another topic and let's talk about me.
Thank you, Olivier. Yeah, I'm excited to talk a lot more about you and your ideas today. Yeah, thank you for the important work that you're doing. And we've been saying, oh, it'd be so great to have Olivier visit the center here in Boston sometime. So maybe one day we can make that happen.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So, I want to, on behalf of the center, really appreciate all the work that you've been doing on dialogue. It's helped us tremendously in the work that we do and sharing about specifically Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy. And so when we were thinking about this episode on what do we mean by dialogue at the center, your name immediately came to mind, Olivier, and we thought, who better to talk about dialogue than the person we've been really studying from? And so we thought we could start with this question of having you help us really define dialogue from Daisaku Ikeda's perspective.
Thank you. So I'd like to start with the definition I used in the book I published in 2010. It's entitled Daisaku Ikeda's Philosophy of Peace. And so that was 16 years ago. This is what I wrote, that for Daisaku Ikeda, in my opinion, dialogue is the communicative use of language, ideas, and reason in order to bring out the best in oneself and others. The goal is not to win arguments, but to enhance the dialogue partner's feelings of shared humanity, unquote. But today, 16 years later, I'd like to propose an expanded definition. I keep some of it, but I learned lots of things, and I think the world also has changed, and there's been developments in various fields since 2010. So for today, I'd like to propose this new definition. Dialogue is the communicative use of our presence, our bodies, our emotions, including through language, ideas, and reasons, in order to bring out the best in oneself and others. So that would be my new definition for today. This inclusion of various modes of communication is influenced by the work on music and peace building I've been doing with the Min-On Music Research Institute since 2014, and also something that I've been thinking about since the publication of the book. As soon as the book was published in 2010, and I have this definition of dialogue based on logic and reason, and then so I was a bit disturbed with the popularity of this exhibition of photographs by Daisaku Ikeda entitled Dialogue with Nature. How can you have a dialogue with nature through photography? And then, so I realized, oh, maybe one day I should update this definition. That, of course, there is the Greek dialogos, through reason through logic. That's dialogue. But now we use dialogue for, I think, any deep connection we can have with people, and especially this is the way Masaaki Ikeda uses it. So dialogue with nature, I think it's worth going back to the exhibition. It's, it was since 1982, almost 100 different pictures of that Masaaki Ikeda took all over the world when he was touched, when he felt something about the natural environment he was in. And it traveled through more than 40 countries. And it's not about words and logic. It's really about a physical connection with your environment that is captured through, through what you see, and then sharing that with others. So, yeah, I feel much, much more comfortable now with this definition of dialogue as being what, ways to connect deeply with ourselves and with each other and with the biosphere and everything.
I love this sort of enhanced or new version of this definition, Olivier. And we have the book. It's such a great book. I have it right here with me. And so I also encourage that you are continuing to have a dialogue with yourself and with Ikeda, as since the publication of this book. And I love the inclusion of the words of our presence, bodies, and emotions. And I resonated a lot with that. And I've been thinking a lot about how for Ikeda, dialogue is really this way of being and becoming. And so it's like really about our lived experiences as humans, and that encompasses like so much. And so I feel like the way that you articulated it is, yeah, so beautiful. And so thank you for sharing that. And I love that you kept, of course, the very important part of this definition, which is this goal, right? To bring out the best in oneself and others. And sort of mystically, just earlier this week, we had a group of high school students come to the center, and we shared your definition from your 2010 book, and this aspect of bringing out the best in oneself and others. And I think there was this question, like, what does that mean to bring out the best in ourself and then in the other person, right? How often do we have a dialogue where we actually do that? And so if you could, Olivia, unpack a little bit more for us how you define this, the best that is in oneself and in others.
Oh wow, that's a really great question that I can feel now we are entering a real dialogue where we will have to improvise a little bit. But thank you. Yeah, very, very good question. So of course an old answer to that question is in the chapter preceding the dialogue chapter. So chapter five is about the importance of courage, wisdom, and compassion. So one simple answer from 2010 would be that what is best in each human being is their capacity to generate, to respond with courage, with wisdom, with compassion. And based on that, what I found out since that time is there is a source for all that, which is life itself. If you're not present and alive, and vibrant, it's very difficult to even think about generating anything like courage, wisdom, and compassion. So this life force that we have, life itself, our creativity, for me is very important because that's what produces courage, wisdom, and compassion, and also produces the less positive sides of us. And I'd like to quote a speech from Dasako Ikeda in 1974, where he said, I'm going to quote from that, "Never, for an instant, forget the effort to renew your life, to build yourself anew. Creativity means to push open the heavy, groaning doorway of life itself. This is not an easy task. Indeed, it may be the most severely challenging struggle there is. For opening the door to your own life is in the end more difficult than opening the door to all the mysteries of the universe. And end of the quote. So you're here, I'm here, we are now in dialogue, and then hopefully you, the auditor, like lots of people, we listen to this. So we are, in a way, all in this dialogue. And what are we doing? What are we just trying to advertise our greatness, or what are we doing? According to what I understand, what we're trying to do is to connect at the deepest level. But for that, I have to be in the moment. Like, it's about my life here and now, and how I'm trying to be more authentic, to be a little bit more courageous, wise, and I think you're doing trying to do the same too. So by me doing it, you're doing it, and by you doing it, I'm doing it. And so in the moment, I think that is the best that is inside each of us. So of course, how Dasaku Ikeda came. I mean, I think that's what he's doing, but came to this is a lot thanks to his mentor, his own mentor, Josei Toda. Famously, Josei Toda clarified the difference between relative and absolute happiness, two types of happiness. So relative happiness depends on a result outside ourselves. For example, when we reach a goal, we feel great about that, and that's relative happiness. In contrast, absolute happiness is completely self-motivated. Even if you don't reach your result, you can still be absolutely happy. I would say it is linked to exactly the amount of courage, of wisdom, and compassion that you are able to generate to respond to what happens to us. And therefore, the goal of dialogue is to awaken absolute happiness in oneself and in others through the process of dialogue. So I'd like to quote maybe other authors outside of the tradition of Makiguchi, Toda, and Ikeda. One of my favorite is Viktor Frankl. He survived several concentration camps during the Nazi Holocaust and has a tremendous credibility for me. So in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, in one of the editions, he added a postscript, and I'd like to quote from that. Saying yes to life in spite of everything presupposes that life is potentially meaningful under any conditions, even those which are most miserable. And this in turn presupposes the human capacity to creatively turn life's negative aspects into something positive or constructive. In other words, what matters is to make the best of any given situation. And that's from Frankl. So, in summary, my understanding of the goal of dialogue for Ikeda is to awaken through the process of dialogue this creativity that we have, this capacity to turn things around, to respond to challenges with courage, wisdom, and compassion. The goal is therefore to expand our humanity and to connect with others at the deepest level. Yeah, I hope that that's a stimulating answer.
Very much so, Olivier, and I think it was really the encouragement I needed to hear today. And I was really struck by your reference of Toda's articulation of happiness, relative and absolute. And I've, of course, as a Buddhist, have studied this concept and have thought about it, but I had never thought about absolute happiness and its connection with dialogue. And so that it was really eye-opening for me to hear. And as you were sharing, the Ikeda quote is one that I thought very much about as well over the years. And as you were talking about this process and what it means to think about the best in oneself and others, I think about Ikeda and the many dialogues he's had. And I've been reading many of his dialogues with his different interlocutors. And just even through the written text, like able to feel his determination to do exactly what you're saying here, to bring out the best in himself and the other. And it's really remarkable the way that he's able to be so fully engaged with the person in front of him. And so, related to this, I wanted to ask you, and this is the question we get a lot at the center, especially people who are new to Ikeda. They ask, so what are the strategies he practiced? You know, how, what strategies did he use when he engaged in dialogue with others? And so I was hoping, Olivia, if you could share some of your insights on that.
That's a really, really great question. And it's very important to be able to think in terms of strategies and skills, because those we can learn. Anybody can learn that anytime, right? If you say, well, first you have to be absolutely happy and then maybe you can have dialogues, then it's a catastrophe. It's really discouraging, right? So it's kind of you do it again and again. Whatever happiness you can bring, whatever confidence and calm you can bring to a dialogue, you do that. But you can add a whole bunch of skills and strategies to make the dialogue even more effective. And by doing that, you will deepen your own capacity for courage, wisdom, and compassion. So that being said, skills and strategies are very, very important, and there are many, many available. So I'd like to mention a few which are safely stored in the old book from 2010. I'll start with that. So one thing he does is he prepares when he has an appointment for a dialogue. He prepares thoroughly. He studies the biography, the life, but also the work of the dialogue partners, not only their biographies. So for instance, in his dialogue with David Krieger, he talks about nuclear abolition in a very knowledgeable way. With Majid Turanian, he talks about the history of Islam. With René Simard, he talks about cancer research. With René Wiik, he talks about art history. So it's impossible for any human being to be an expert in those four in any lifetime, right? So that's not the point. The point, I think, is that Ikeda is very interested in the person and tries to put themselves in the shoes of the person. What is this person thinking about all the time? What have they been spending the last 20 years working on that I can try to understand enough so that they feel ready to open up? If I really don't understand what they are doing, that the dialogue's not going to go so well, right? So I think there is this effort of understanding the person, but also what they do. And that's that's very encouraging, I think. And then, of course, I think we all do that. Always try to create intimacy with the dialogue partners by asking personal questions, like icebreakers, little ways of feeling close and laughing, and then having a more serious discussion. So, for instance, he did that. Obviously, he's very clear in the published dialogues with Hazel Henderson, Joseph Rotblat, Johan Galtung, Linus Pauling. For most listeners, this is those are just names. But the point of those names is that it would be normal to be very, very intimidated by those people, right? Hazel Henderson, a major environmentalist, Joseph Rotblat, the only one who quit the Manhattan Project in the middle because he learned some stuff. Johan Galtung, the founder of Peace Studies. Linus Pauling, who discovered vitamin C. Those are the people that you have now in front of you, and you have to create intimacy in 5 minutes with those people, So that's definitely a very important skill. How do you see the person in front of you as a human being? Lillian, you are very intimidating too, but I'm trying to look at you as a human being and understand what you're interested about, So another skill is moving towards more abstract and general topics, maybe entering the field of the person that you're talking with, but gradually. So by keeping the interests of these dialogue partners in mind. So first you create a personal and emotional connection. and then with the person, and then with the events themselves. For example, in his dialogue with Majid Tehranian, President Ikeda, at some point makes a very powerful general statement about war. But before that, there was this connection with an experience that Majid had about war, and they connected at that level and then went to a more abstract discussion. Another skill is to highlight an important principle. In the case of Ikeda, of course, it's based on everything that he knows, including Buddhism. And sometimes the interlocutor himself or herself mentions it. So, for instance, in the dialogue with Mikhail Gorbachev, so Gorbachev was sharing about the new thinking. The new thinking is pretty important because that's what ended the Cold War. That's one strong element that caused the dissolution of the whole Soviet Union. So, it's not just, this morning I'm thinking about something. It's like a very powerful way of thinking in a different way. And Gorbachev mentions that one of the major elements of this new thinking was an awareness of interdependence, an awareness of mutual interdependence. And that's, of course, something that Ikeda strongly believes in too, interdependence, interconnectedness between all forms of life and all forms of being. So then once Gorbachev said that, then Ikeda confirmed that, and he said, yes, this is very important in all human affairs, actually. And you can, when at least on paper, when you read the dialogue, you can see that they really connected based on that common understanding that they have on of interdependence. Another skill is using a disagreement to come to some common ground, right? So interdependence, oh, of course, interdependence, you agree, I agree, life is wonderful. But what if you don't agree about something strongly? What do you do next, right? So in the dialogue with Arnold Toynbee, a major British historian, that discussion happened during the 1970s, and there was a question about where is the world, where is humanity heading to in the 70s? And about half a century ago, but it sounds kind of familiar. It's kind of scary. Anyway, let's go back to the 70s. And Toynbee says, well, the world is basically in chaos. And what is going to happen is that we are going to have a dictatorship, a ruthless, short-lived world dictatorship. And after that, we're going to have a kind of milder form of government, but still dictatorial, so that we can bring order to the chaotic world that we are in. And Toynbee said that based off his very, very deep knowledge of history. Happened before in different civilization. So it's a very strong point. However, Ikeda doesn't agree. He actually very, very strongly disagrees. And he tells Toynbee, I paraphrase, of course, well, the real problem is actually the human heart. That's the real problem. The heart of human beings, especially the lust for power. The lust for power doesn't come just from the sky, it's in people. So the solution must be found in the heart of human beings. And also in the heart of human beings. That's very essential. But Toynbee doesn't go, oh, yes, I give up. You're absolutely right. No. Toynbee, sticks to his guns, literally. And he doesn't give up on his dark prediction of having that a ruthless dictatorship is coming. However, he also finds a point of consensus with Ikeda. And I quote here from Toynbee, I agree that the essential evil of power is an innate tendency in human nature, and that we must search for means of mitigating this evil. End of the quote. So when I read that, let's say we are back in the 70s, I feel like, oh yeah, we're in big trouble. A big, a really horrible dictatorship is coming to us. But we have maybe a little bit of wiggle room to try to avoid that, to by, transforming ourselves and others, and I would add through dialogue. So that's how important dialogue is in this context, right? So, in other words, oh, this is still Toynbee continues. End of the quote. In other words, self-mastery is the only way to happiness for the individual and for all humanity. End of quote. So I think that is a very important skill. Like you have a sincere dialogue with someone, and then they say something that you really, really don't agree with. How do you keep in the conversation, and how do you keep on bringing the best in yourself and the other, and come to maybe you can agree to disagree. That's also fine, another skill is to give your dialogue partner your full attention. So I've had the great honor to meet Ikeda in person 12 times, sometimes 5 minutes, sometimes 10 minutes, sometimes a whole dinner. And yeah, that he has this way of making you feel you're the most important person in the room, which was never true, and the most important person in the world, which is absolutely not true. So I think being able to give your full attention to someone in person, and even in the writing, it comes out. And when you read the dialogues, the books, you feel, wow, this person is more important than I thought, And for instance, Professor Radhakrishnan, an expert on Gandhi, who had several dialogues with Daisaku Ikeda, I will quote what he says. The manner in which Ikeda engages a person in dialogue is based on the profound worth he accords to each individual, unquote. So, with that, I can go back to the definition of dialogue I proposed earlier. I just repeat it. Dialogue is the communicative use of our presence, our bodies, our emotions, including through language, ideas, and reasons, in order to bring out the best in oneself and others. And then you can see the impact on dialogue partners, which can be described as the profound worth he accords to each individual. So whatever skills and techniques, and there's so many we are willing to learn to improve the quality and the depth of our dialogues. I think if we keep in mind this question, will this person feel more worthy if I do this, if I say this, if I don't say this, will I feel more worthy, as far as my intrinsic worth as a person. Thank you. That was a long answer, but it was such a good question. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. I really appreciate that in the book, and then again now, you articulating these strategies, because as you said, as you were going through them, I feel these are strategies that any of us listening or reading can think about how we might apply them. And I was thinking, imagine if the leaders of our world today practice dialogue using these strategies. Our world would look very different, I'm sure. And number five is one that I think has come up a lot in the center's work. It just how do we disagree but still respect the other person, and to disagree and still be able to, as you said, right, to make the dialogue partner feel this profound worth that they have. And so that is really hard to practice, but the examples you gave were very, very helpful. So thank you so much, Olivier. It's so great to go back to these strategies with you. And so you mentioned, a few thinkers already during our dialogue today, and I was wondering if you could share, I know you've done extensive research on this, other thinkers that you've found that who have resonated with Ikeda's perspective.
Oh yes, there are many. Fortunately, there are many. So in the book, Daisaku Ikeda's Philosophy of Peace, I mentioned some, so I'm going to repeat this and then add a few more. So if we take that aspect of Socrates, as quoted by Plato, Socrates talks about people who hate ideas. He calls that the mythologists. And he says, if you hate ideas, basically you're going to end up hating people. And according to Socrates, he's based on ignorance of the world. So I think that's why he was such a great educator, because he thought, oh, if people could just know more, understand more, they would love all kinds of ideas more, and then they would love each other more, right? So this concept that hating ideas, different ideas, complex ideas, will lead you to hate people. I think that that's very, very important, and I think we can see in the thousands and thousands of pages published by Ikeda that he loves ideas and he loves people. Then there is the French philosopher Michel de Montaigne. A beautiful quote here. He says, "My thought sketches out the matter for a while and dwell slightly on the first aspects of it. Then I usually leave the principal thrust of the task to heaven." So in other ways, when you start a dialogue, you have some plan, you have some ideas, and you mention that, but then you need to be free enough to improvise. So since the goal is to connect, not to win, not to convince, to connect, then you don't really have to stick to a precise agenda. And we can see that Ikeda does that. My father used to not like very much the dialogue books, because he would say it's all over the place. But yeah, it's there is that. But if you read them a second time, you'll see that there are very clear patterns also, right? Another thinker is Martin Buber. Famously wrote a book called I and Thou, the very worthy you. And a very short quote from Buber: "I require a you to become. Becoming I say you. All actual life is encounter." And I hear deep resonance with the African philosophy of Ubuntu in that. So the point here from Buber, which I think is very present in Ikeda's work, is that dialogue changes the people involved in the dialogue in the moment of practicing the dialogue. It's not just an exchange of information. In a way, the information is secondary. It's about reciprocal, mutual, and change in real time together. Yeah. Jürgen Habermas, German philosopher, very, very complicated and lots of fancy words. I invite everybody to read some Habermas if they are interested. But to use a very simple language, he talks about the unconstrained, unifying, consensus-bringing force of argumentative speech. So, from what I understand, Habermas believed that for a healthy society, you need to be able to discuss freely in public spaces without oppression, without repression. You can say whatever you want, and then you can also listen to the responses freely and have, consensus bringing. He believed that if you argue long enough with a sincere desire to come to some kind of common ground or some kind of deeper understanding, consensus will arise naturally. That's what I understand from Habermas. So trusting the process of dialogue, this free consensus bringing possibility of the dialogue, I think is what is in common between Habermas and Ikeda. And there's many others which are not in the 2000 book, of course. I just mentioned two now, but I mean, with ChatGPT now, it's like, who are the greatest champions of dialogue? You're going to have a whole bunch of references or we, any other platform. You know, I'm not advertising a special platform. David Bohm is a major dialogist. I mean, he wrote a book called On Dialogue and many other publications. So it's from what I understand for Bohm, the goal is the emergence of a shared insight rather than victory. So participants suspend assumptions as much as possible and think together instead of defending positions. So a very simple image of that is, for example, so we are in a real room, we are in a room. So you, Liliane, and myself, we are in a room and we are facing each other, one chair each, and a table in the middle. And there is this problem of climate change, and we don't agree. So da 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 da, I say this, and you contradict me, and okay, we can do that for a long time. Or we can sit next to each other and look at climate change together. And I contribute what I understand, you contribute what you understand, but we together we contribute to understanding ourselves first, maybe the worries or the assumptions about climate change, and then understanding each other and then understanding the issue more. And that's how I understand David Bohm. Another one is Emmanuel Levinas. What there is in common with my understanding of Dasko Ikeda's philosophy and practice of dialogue is a profound commitment to the dignity of each person, the worth of each person, so that there's no doubt that they have that in common. But for Levinas, from what I understand, this starts when you meet somebody. He calls that the face of the other. So Levinas says that we have an ethical responsibility when we encounter another person, when we encounter the face of the other. So Ikeda agrees that respect for the dignity of life, compassionate action is essential. Of course, it's a core virtue. But I think it's grounded in a belief that every person possesses creativity, the potential to bring out courage, wisdom, compassion inherently, even before you meet anybody. So, of course, if you do meet somebody, then the whole process can start when you see the face of the other, as Levinas says. But alone in a room or alone walking in nature, there's no difference for Ikeda because inside of you, there is always this profound self-motivation that is there waiting. That will be the difference between the two. Yeah. So yeah, we can continue forever quoting people who have made so many efforts and realized so many great achievements about dialogue. But I think Lillian, you will, and me too, we will study more about this from now on. So I wanted to give a little taste of how huge the field of dialogical research and practice is. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so important, Olivier, because I think dialogue is something, again, we're just talking about this with the young people who are at the center. It's not really something that you learn about in school or they talk about in their interactions with their friends and in the discourse right now in society. And but yet it's so important and it's so encouraging to see how many thinkers have been talking and practicing dialogue in the same ways that Ikeda has. And so it's so important, yeah, what you just shared with us. So thank you. And related to that, I think we are often asking ourselves, how did we get to where we are now? And, as Toynbee shared, right, in his dialogue with Ikeda, just history repeating itself and how do we find new paths and how do we really create peace? And so this leads to my next question for you, Olivier, which is a big one, and I'm really excited to hear your answer, which is, as you know, because you've written extensively about Ikeda's philosophy of peace, for him, he really believed that dialogue is the surest path piece, and he personally engaged with that work. And so we always get the question from our people who come to the center, is it really the path towards path to peace? Aren't there other paths? Is dialogue really the solution? And so I was hoping you could convince our, everybody who's listening, why do you think Ikeda really believes this? And why does he see dialogue as such an essential tool or path to peace?
Well, thank you. That's a really great question. And thank you so much, Lillian, for inviting me to try to convince anybody, but I politely refuse. I want to
It's not very
connect.
dialogic.
I want to connect, not to convince.
Right. This is not a debate.
Yes. So, peace is a very vague word. Most people have a very different picture, definition, desire when we pronounce this word. I personally, I prefer peace building because it's about what we do, what we think, what we say, the processes, and it's in, from now on towards the future. However, the part of your question I can answer is why it seems that Ikeda believes that dialogue is the surest path to peace. Why is it that he would have devoted his life to that, right? That's that question I can try to answer. So I'll start with a quote from Daisaku Ikeda from the book From the Ashes, which was published in 2001. Quote: "Unless we can achieve a fundamental transformation within our own lives, so that we are able to perceive our intimate connection with all our fellow human beings and feel their sufferings as our own, we will never be free of conflict and war. In this sense, I feel that a hard power approach, one that relies on military might, will not lead to a long-term fundamental resolution." End of the quote. So I think th this is pretty clear in this. And then there is a second half of this long quote that I'd like to continue. "I believe that dialogue holds the key to any lasting solution. Now, more than ever, we must reach out in a further effort to understand each other and engage in genuine dialogue. Words spoken from the heart have the power to change a person's life. They can even melt the icy walls of mistrust that separates people and nations. We must expand our efforts to promote dialogue between and among civilizations." Unquote. Right, so this is in a book called From the Ashes, published in 2001, after the attacks on the US on 9/11. Several thinkers and people of in a position of spiritual leadership got together and published this book with a response to what happened and the way possible ways forward. Yeah, very, very important book, I think. So going back to the question, the part of your question that I'm going to take, which is that why does he see dialogue as essential to peace building? The short answer is that, and I personally agree with this, that without an improvement of people's capacity for goodness, for courage, wisdom, compassion, capacity to resist impulses towards greed, anger, foolishness, there will be no real peace building in the long term. So, the long answer I'd like to share is this is my personal opinion. Those are thoughts and opinions and readings and things I've learned in the last 16 years that have become very important to me that I'd like to share because that's my update on the book, if you want. So, why such an emphasis on dialogue by Ikeda? I think it can be seen from various angles, and I'd like to bring in three different strands from psychology, neuroscience, sociology, actually popular psychology, neuroscience, and science sociology, because I'm not an expert in any of those three, to clarify what I have in mind. So I'm busy studying all those now, and it is absolutely fascinating. So there seems to be some kind of convergence between various disciplines towards a distinction between two things: attitudes that are conducive to good health, to harmony, to peace building, and for that, dialogue is an excellent means. And on the other hand, attitude based on toxicity, division, violence. And for that, you use manipulation, intimidation, not dialogue in the, Ikeda's definition. So I'd like to go over those now. And if anything sounds too long, you can very kindly stop me. That's okay. You just the keyword, just say connect, connect, and then I'll stop. All right. So in the field of applied psychology, called assertiveness training, and there's a whole bunch of famous names associated with that. It has been developed for decades, since like the 1950s. So my own understanding of this field goes like this: in human relationships, conflicts are inevitable. If you speak long enough, you talk long enough with somebody, you will come to a disagreement. It's totally natural. It's totally normal. But what is important is how we deal with that, as we've seen already, right? And according to what I understand of assertiveness training, there are three options. Okay, there's a disagreement now. Okay, fine, you're absolutely right. I give up. That's fine. Yeah, go ahead, have your way. And then you become passive, and it's one way of avoiding the conflict. Or if you always want to win, then you will be aggressive. You will do whatever it takes to win. You will lie, you will manipulate, whatever it takes to, as long as you win. And in the middle, if you respect yourself and respect others, then you can be assertive. And it's very difficult because it's in the moment, and you always have to find a balance between being a little bit too aggressive and a little bit too passive. But to continue the dialogue and continue the connection, assertiveness is the key, right? So we see that if you're passive or if you are aggressive, you exclude the type of dialogue practiced by Ikeda. Only an attitude, a healthy attitude of assertiveness, infused with respect for oneself and others, can be at the basis of dialogue. So that's applied psychology. Now, if we move to neurobiology, really popular basic neurobiology, and I got that from one chapter in a book by James Doty called Mind Magic. It's a really amazing book because it says that the magic of life is a lot inside our minds. And his definition of mind includes the body, the nervous system, the brain, not just thinking and using words, the whole thing, right? So, what I learned from that chapter is the very important concepts of dysregulation and regulation, which are invisible but have a tremendous visible impact. So dysregulation is when you don't feel safe, and it can go from being a little bit nervous inside to being in a total panic and panic attack or anything. There's a whole range, but it's called dysregulation. And of course, regulation is that when you feel safe, when you feel stable. So, to make a long tale short, and entering a field I really don't know, so I probably say things that are not totally correct. But from what I understand, we have part of our nervous system is called the autonomic nervous system because it works a lot for us without us telling it anything. For example, our heartbeat. This system is in charge of our heartbeat, of our breathing. When we sleep, for example, we don't control our breathing, we still breathe. Our digestion. All that is part of the autonomic nervous system. But there are at least two branches. One that allows our fight or flight response. So if we are something, like we don't see the car, but we jump backwards, and then the car comes and we see it. Our body was able to perceive that there was danger, and automatically our muscles tensed and we jumped back and we saved our lives, right? So this happens all the time, this fight or flight response. But if we are all the time in fight or flight response, we become nervous wrecks and we die very quickly. Fortunately, there is the other one, the rest and digest response, that brings us back to balance, right? So when we don't feel safe, if there is a reason to be worried or afraid, we go immediately in fight or flight mode. So our heartbeat accelerates, our muscles become tense, we are ready to fight or to run away, to flight. And on the contrary, when we feel safe, then we go back into rest and digest mode. And this process, this constant process of back and forth between the two, is called homeostasis. It's like the body is trying to keep a good balance, a dynamic equilibrium, physically and then emotionally and mentally. So when we are able to switch back into the rest and digest mode, our heartbeat, our breathing, our blood pressure, our digestion, everything goes back to normal and our muscles relax. Now, this is so important for dialogue, because what we say is important, but how we say it is even more important, and how we say it comes from those two nervous systems. So for instance, Lillian, if you're making me very nervous at a physical gut level, even though I use beautiful words and, oh, I published this book and I published this book, something's going to come out in my voice that shows that I'm not safe. I don't feel safe. And then depending on how safe you are, you might be influenced by that. So if my being unsafe is stronger than your being safe, we are both going to be nervous and it's not going to go well. If I'm nervous and you are very, very safe, powerfully safe, this will have an impact on me and is going to calm me down. That's called co-regulation. So this is invisible. We can see the effects, but we cannot see the processes. It's completely invisible. And I would say it's like a huge part of the dialogue process that we have to take into account, right? So other human beings, or rather the self-regulated nervous systems of other human beings, strongly detect these states. So even if we use beautiful words and sentences, if we are in fight or flight mode, the other person will feel it and they might start feeling nervous too. So are we connecting with another human being from a place of safety, which means in rest and digest mode? It's called parasympathetic technically, but it's a bit too long. So rest and digest mode, or from a place of insecurity in fight or flight mode. That's called sympathetic mode. Yeah. So, according to what I understand of Ikeda's dialogues, dialogue must be based on the intention to bring out the best in oneself and others from a place of deep calm, security, and safety from the rest and digest mode of our nervous system. At the same time, the intention to bring out the best in oneself and others stimulate our confidence, our feeling of safety, and our rest and digest mode. And the 12 times I've met Ikeda, I remember them. And there's something I didn't notice until recently, until I understood this. Now that I go back to those movies in my head, I realize Ikeda is always incredibly calm. He's excited, he's passionate, he's engaged, he's funny, but very, very calm. And I didn't know that, and it's not in the book of 2010, but it's in our conversation today. So that is so important for a good dialogue. And then finally, the third aspect from sociology, from an author called Ryan Eisler. She made a very clear distinction between cooperation and domination. She wrote several books. One of them is called The Callus and the Blade, about our history and our future as human beings. And she
Mm.
established a dichotomy between societies that are based on the dominance model and societies based on the partnership model. But this is also valid for human, for individuals. It goes from individuals to groups to societies to entire world and countries. So I'd like to put all those three together, everything together, and try to answer the question, how do I see that Sakoikeda's belief that dialogue is the surest path to peace, and why he sees dialogue as essential to peace building? To make a now very, very long tale short, for me, dialogue can be placed at the opposite side of violence. So once we use violence, mentally, verbally, physically, culturally, structurally, any type of violence, this is the end of dialogue and the beginning of coercion. So in assertiveness training, it is dialogue that allows people to be assertive and to connect with others. And once someone uses passivity to submit or aggressiveness to control, there's no more dialogue. In neurobiology, it is the deep calm of our bodies and emotions when our rest and digest system is on that allows for healthy exchanges with people. If you are in a state of fear and dysregulation, there can be no dialogue as Ikeda has been practicing. So actually, we can have a really great dialogue with one person just listening. But listening actively, listening, even being silent, breathing, feeling very, very calm, really understanding the other person. Oh, wow, this person just spoke for 1 hour. You didn't say anything. That wasn't a dialogue. Well, yes, because the nervous systems were maybe communicating very strongly that one person was trying to help the other person feel safer, bringing out the best in them through silence and listening, right? A little bit paradoxical, but I think that it is possible to have dialogue without saying a word, you know. So, in other words, dialogue entails assertiveness, deep calm, and partnership in the context of these huge fields I've just mentioned. At the opposite end of violence, violence is used for aggressiveness, for passivity also, and it comes with dysregulation a lot, and it's an essential tool for dominance. So, I think I've tried to answer this very, very complex question. Those are not things that Ikeda wrote or said, but I feel that we can understand more how somebody can have such a conviction that dialogue is a direct, really powerful path towards peace building and a more livable world, a more harmonious world collectively. I think it's backed up by a lot of knowledge from all kinds of fields. And I think you and I right now, and I hope the listeners will right now here in this moment as we are listening, we are all assertive. We keep, we kind of stick to our guns a little bit, but we are flexible. And we are able to listen, not trying to dominate or to submit, but right in the middle, really trying to connect. And I think we are both very calm. At least you, Lian, you seem very, very calm, deeply calm physically. And I don't think we are dreaming of a society where everybody who is stronger can dominate others. I don't think that's the kind we want. We much prefer partnership. It's just an example, concrete example of what those big words mean. It's about our daily practice of dialogue in daily life. Yeah. Sorry, this is becoming so long. Thank you for listening.
Was absolutely amazing and enlightening. I think as human beings, we're so complex and we all have our own stories and I know Ikeda talks about dialogue also being this courageous willingness to know and be known. And I think to do that, we have to understand the ways that we live and the ways that as human beings, why, we behave a certain way or how we respond, to really observe that. And so I think these different frameworks to look at Ikeda's way of engaging in dialogue is so helpful, Olivier. So I really deeply appreciate you walking us through that. I feel like I was taking a class and I felt very calm. So you definitely have that very calming presence. And I appreciate what you said about Ikeda too. I've never met him in person, but obviously have felt like I've had many dialogues with him through reading his writings and our letter correspondences. And I've always felt this very grounding and calming presence. So yeah, and I think these different frameworks that you're bringing in, these different fields, Olivier, is so helpful because I think in this current moment that we're in, you alluded to this earlier as well, where there's so much divisiveness and where dialogue seems harder than ever. I think a question that comes up a lot for especially the young people we meet is how do we have dialogues with those who aren't willing to be in dialogue with us? And, when those things happen, right, should we still try to engage? And you mentioned this fight or flight, right? I think in those dialogues, I think that state is often triggered, and not the rest and digest. And so, what do you think we should do in these situations? And what would Ikeda's perspective be on this?
Oh, another fantastic question. Thank you so much. Yes. Yeah, I do have something to say about this. So, I'd like to quote from this Ikeda's speech at the University of Palermo in 2007. The two wheels that support dialogue are a belief that everyone possesses goodness within, and a spirit of unflagging determination to tap and draw out that goodness. So what I see in this sentence is theory and practice. The belief is the theory, and the determination is the practice. So I think that first and foremost, Ikeda would reaffirm his belief, if he's confronted with this question, like, is it okay to have dialogue with absolutely anybody, even people who refuse dialogue? Or, I think first his belief that each human being has the potential for courage, wisdom, and compassion, no matter how appearances seem to contradict this belief. Looking at the behavior of various people today, we might feel like giving up on the belief that they have the potential to do anything good. But this is a question of conviction. It's a belief. It's an axiom. So in a way, it's non-negotiable. If you want to go, I mean, that's my personal opinion, but if you want to walk the path of dialogue, there are some parameters you're going to have to stick to, because it's not easy at all. It's very, very difficult, right? So I think at some point in his education and his development, Ikeda realized that for what he wanted to accomplish, it was much more productive to believe in people's potential than not believing in it. And his mentor, Jose Toda, had the same conviction. And Jose Toda's mentor, Makiguchi, had the same conviction. So I think in theory, the theory of it is that, yes, we should try to engage with absolutely anything that moves, anybody, based on this conviction. That's the theory. That's the ideal that we keep in our hearts and that motivates us. Okay. Now, I'm going to take some risk here and say what I think personally, that in reality, it's more complicated than that. And because there are people with whom, honestly, we will waste our time, not because of who they are, but because of the time, the situation. Maybe they are in a very bad mood this morning and it's not the right time. Just wait, so there is a question of timing also. And sometimes you can put yourself in harm's way. You meet somebody in a dark alley instead of, hiding on running away. Oh, I want to have a nice dialogue. It could go wrong. So we need a lot of courage, wisdom, and compassion, the whole thing, to decide at a certain point, oh, yes, this is the time for dialogue, or maybe this is the time for avoiding dialogue. And decide if it's going to be productive, it's going to be useful in a specific situation with specific people for you and for the other, right? So it's just my opinion, but in my own limited experience, I feel that it's better to avoid spending too much time with someone who tries to dominate me, especially this distinction by Ryan Asler. If I feel somebody is into the dominance mode and trying to order me around or make me do something I don't want to do or say something I don't want to say, I use a whole bunch of avoidance techniques, and I flight. I run away in a way, right? Even if physically you have to stay there. But what we can do, we can spend a lot of time with people who can become our allies. We can spend an infinite amount of time doing that, right? So I think it's all case by case. But people in the domination model, the dominance model, they might change all of a sudden. They might go through an event that makes them want to listen and open up to partnership. A famous historic example is King Ashoka. He was totally in the dominance model. He was a very successful and ruthless dictator. But then he saw death and suffering, and it affected him in such a way that he went fully into the partnership model. So change is always possible, right? However, even though we believe that everybody has interesting intrinsic worth and dialogue might go well with anybody, I think we need a lot of wisdom. And sometimes not picking up the phone and calling the person and not sending that email is actually showing respect to yourself and the other. So that's I hope that's not too shocking for somebody who has studied dialogue to say that sometimes dialogue doesn't work or should be avoided. But that's my experience and that's my opinion.
That it was so helpful, Olivier. I was just talking to a friend yesterday, and he was sharing about a friend that he has in his life where he often feels that his efforts in dialogue are not being reciprocated, and he was grappling with what he should do. And I think your guidance would be really helpful for him. And I love that you said that we can use our courage, wisdom, and compassion to evaluate the situation. So we still have, a role to play in it. And it could be choosing not to dialogue with the person, but that also allows us to have dialogue with ourselves. And so, I really love that. And I think in some ways, when I read all of Ikeda's dialogues, I haven't read all of them, of course, there's so many, but I think he really does engage in dialogue with people who maybe think differently from him, but are not in these dominance mo models. They are willing to be, to be engaged and willing to be open. And I think even if they think very differently from Ikeda, that they're still willing to have this partnership. And so, that's really so helpful. I think this next question, I know you've had many. Earlier you said with your limited experience, I know you were being very humble, Olivier, because I'm sure you've had so many experiences of engaging in dialogue. And so I wanted to know if you've had can share an experience where through engaging in this kind of dialogue that we've been talking about with someone that you were transformed yourself.
Yes, thank you, thank you. When I was preparing this interview, my first answer was no. But fortunately, something emerged in my consciousness that I'd like to share, a very recent dialogue that happened. So I was discussing with a former graduate student, somebody who just she had just graduated from the program, and I was her supervisor. And we have now post-graduation conversations, and she will recognize herself. So, hello, nice to have you listen to this podcast. So, I was explaining this point about, Ryan Eisler's distinction between the dominance model and the partnership model. And she was listening and absorbing. And wow, I was so proud of myself. Again, I can teach even after she doesn't take the class. How wonderful. And then when I stopped, she said, "There's something very, very wrong with the picture you just described." And one option would be, "Well, I have a very important appointment and I have to go now." But I thought, wow, this is great. It looks like I feel like I'm gonna learn something now. I'm gonna learn something very interesting. So, remaining very calm, of course, and assertive and compassionate and open, I asked her, "Well, please tell me in detail what you have in mind." And then she said basically that all the examples of dominance models that I gave were from the right side of the political spectrum, and all the examples of partnership were from the left hand side of the political spectrum. And of course, those could be reversed very easily if you know your history well, right? So I realized at that moment that if I'm really serious about opposing dominance models, opposing violence, promoting partnership, opposing violence, aggression, submission, promoting dialogue. If I'm really serious about this, then I really have to rise above political and ideological categories, and especially my own biases and prejudices, right? And that was such, this had such a profound impact, this dialogue, that I've been doing that ever since. Like something really clicked in my mind, and I'm constantly aware of the potential stereotypes that I use when I give examples. I still make mistakes, but at least I became fully conscious through that dialogue. Yeah.
It's such a great example, Olivier, and I think it's so timely in this moment that we're in, especially in the US where I'm living, to be. I think one of the scholars that we've engaged in dialogue with shared that for her, when engaging in dialogue, it's so important to be open to the possibility that we may be wrong. And I think that's so hard when you're in fight or flight mode to recognize that. So, I love that you shared that in that moment, you could have flight to an appointment. Very important appointment, but you didn't, and you stayed with this. Ikeda talks about it in one of the messages he sent to the center, this humble willingness to learn. That is for him this a very important part of this dialogue of spiritual openness. So you really exhibited that through this dialogue, and what courage your student had to, in some ways share what she felt, from her heart, and to be open to being in dialogue with you. So she sounds like a wonderful student. So hope you're listening and enjoying this conversation, said student. So it's been such a wonderful dialogue, Olivia. I really appreciate you spending so much time. And we are at the end of the conversation, and we have this one last question. And I was really curious what you were going to share because you have so many quotes on dialogue from Ikeda that you've shared with the world, that you've engaged with yourself. And so I'm sure it's a hard one for you to answer. But the question that I wanted to end our dialogue with is if you have a favorite quote from Ikeda on dialogue that you return to.
Thank you for again a wonderful last question. And actually, there's two quotes that I really, really like. And one is about a drop. Ikeda talks about one drop of the water of dialogue. And that is so important because sometimes I am in very difficult situations, or I'm exhausted, or I really don't want to have dialogue, or I don't believe dialogue is going to work. But I remember that, oh, okay, just one drop is enough. Just a little drop, not the whole thing, just one drop. But then there is the second quote where he talks about a great flood of dialogue. And this one is when I feel great, or when we feel great, can be a source of inspiration. when we are ready to take on the whole world. You know, let's flood the world with dialogue, right? So depending on the situation, I use one or the other. So I would like to end this wonderful exchanges we are having by just quoting those two passages in full. So here is the first one. If one drop of the water of dialogue is allowed to fall upon the wasteland of intolerance, where attitudes of hatred and exclusionism have so long prevailed, there will be a possibility for trust and friendship to spring up. And the second one, rather than fuel the flames of hatred, let's douse them with a great flood of dialogue that will enrich and benefit all humanity. That is all for today.
Thank you so much, Olivier. Those were two incredibly beautiful quotes to conclude our dialogue today. And I love the two images of a drop of water and then this flood of dialogue and how we can do both of them. Yeah, it just makes me feel like for our listeners, to remember that each of us has the power to practice and engage in dialogue, and that this one drop can become a flood, but in some days a drop is enough. And so, yeah, Olivia, I've learned so much from you in this conversation, and I really feel like our listeners are taking so much away as well, especially when we think about how do we really engage with the world at this time with wisdom, courage, and compassion. So, thank you so much, Olivier.
Thank you for inviting me and for such a really transformative dialogue we just had now. So, thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us today for another What Do We Mean By episode. I will include the resources that Dr. Urbain referenced in the episode description. Stay tuned for our next concept. If you have any questions or concepts you'd like to learn about, please email us at podcasts@ikedacenter.org. To learn about the Ikeda Center, you can also visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Until then, happy dialoguing.